K1, November Echo Tango. K2LIW, you got it, Steve.
K2RIW, K1NET, and hello to everybody on the net. I just tuned in and basically just checked in just to make sure I had the tone right. I don't really have any traffic, and yes, we are anchored here at Bay Ridge Anchorage, and I was just tuning around and came across your net, so that's about it. Not much going on, quiet Sunday night, and just waiting to go to work in the morning. We move a little oil here, so we're going to go and go into a berth tomorrow, so got the night off and really enjoying the net. K1NET.
Very fine, Steve. Sounds like you're on an oil tanker. And the guys who sign into this next, sometimes they like big numbers. Roughly how many gallons of oil are you about to deliver, Steve? Go ahead.
Well, we're going to load, I think, roughly 35,000 barrels. And it's 42 gallons to a barrel in bulk. So I got to do some quick math.
I'm doing that math as we speak. 35 exponential 3, 42, multiply, that is 1.47 million barrels, 1.47 million gallons of oil you're about to deliver.
Yep,
1.47 million barrels, a million gallons. I'm impressed. Is that particular tanker that's doing this roughly 800 feet long, Steve, go ahead.
No, this is actually a smaller tug and barge, and that 35,000 is just, it's about half of what the barge holds. So we're taking a half a barge load, and that's kind of the way things have been going. The product is getting so expensive that nobody can afford it, and the people just aren't buying the amounts that they were buying before. Everybody's cutting back, and that's all part of the process of cutting back. If nobody can afford it, nobody's going to buy it, and we won't be moving it.
I'm going to have some fun with you, Steve. Because the stuff that you're delivering is becoming so valuable, black gold, people are going to stop calling it. You're going to need somebody that rides shotgun on that barge to make sure the load is being protected. Have you guys made some jokes about that from time to time? Back to you, Steve.
No, not as of yet. Not as of yet, but that could be something in the future. I don't know. It's, nobody would have ever thought it was going to get as high as it has, so it's we're not sure of what the future holds and what the industry holds, but we do know one thing with the gas and the heating oil, we need it. That's what we do know, so only time will tell, and we'll just see how things go in the future.
Yeah, I'm very disappointed that this country has allowed themselves to become so dependent on foreign energy resources. I think the United States is importing 60% of all the oil we use. I think that's something around 21 million barrels per day. Wow. How the heck we've allowed that to happen as opposed to using our own resources just because it's cheap. But our own resources are a little bit more expensive. So we just lulled ourselves into complacency saying that, hey, it's cheaper to buy it than somebody else, we'll just keep buying it. Well, we're financing some operations that we may not agree with, and we're making ourselves very vulnerable. And from my point of view, we're spilling American blood in the Mideast with the major motivation is to protect that supply of oil. If it wasn't for our need for Mideast oil, I think many of our troops wouldn't be there. We would let those individual countries war with each other. We'd stand back and make comments, but we wouldn't get heavily involved if we didn't need that oil. That's an opinion. And so I sure wish we would concentrate on renewable resources of our own as opposed to depending on somebody else's. There's another way of looking at this whole thing. Let me drop. And that is the Europeans and the Japanese and whatever have been paying $6 per gallon for petroleum products for decades. And by some magic, we've been paying a lot smaller price. We're slowly coming up to the reality of what the rest of the world is paying, with a couple of exceptions. There's one or two countries that are paying very little for petroleum because they're a producer. But much of Europe is paying $6 a gallon, $6.50 a gallon. We may be there pretty soon. I think we're going to suddenly lose a lot of interest in our gas-guzzling SUVs. We're going to be looking much more adoringly at automobiles that get 30 miles to the gallon and not 15 miles to the gallon, as many of those vehicles are getting. A couple of years ago, I was falling in love with a Land Rover Land Cruiser automobile because it had such a nice off-road capability. When I found out it gets 12.5 miles to the gallon, I got discouraged real fast. And as I've said so often, I don't know how in the world the United Kingdom Motor Company that builds the engine that's inside of that Land Rover, how can they make an engine that bad that it gets 12.5 miles to the gallon? Engine / powertrain. Sounds like there's a lot of room for improvement there. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who's signed in. Paul, I wonder if there's some more information you can tell us about what Phoenix has done. Have the solar cells been deployed? And when it comes to Steve Squires, I can understand. Let me drop. I can understand why he would be so heavily involved in the Phoenix operation, because he put many years of his blood, sweat, and tears into Spirit and Opportunity, those Land Rover vehicles. He did such an excellent job that he's a guy with a real passion to make sure that the spacecraft is going to live well and prosper. And so hopefully he was involved with Phoenix, looking over their shoulder and making sure that they didn't forget anything that could create a disaster. Of all the spacecraft that have ever landed on Mars, more than half of them failed on landing. So you can see why these guys at Jet Propulsion Laboratory chewed their nails during that 7 minutes of terror. When it enters the atmosphere and under completely automatic control, it's got to do about 50 or 150 operations at exactly the right time, in exactly the right sequence. Otherwise, terrible things happen. So it's a lot easier to put the space junk that crashes into Mars than to put something into a soft landing that becomes useful afterwards. Over to you, Paul, for anything else you can tell us about Phoenix or anything else about space. WS2N, K2RIW in the deck net.
Okay, I just checked the internet, and the last report I can get is 51 minutes ago. And 51 minutes ago, it just shows that that they had a signal from the Phoenix. So no further news yet until somebody writes something on that computer before I get in front of the TV. Maybe somebody else is watching it, and they can give you an update. I don't know. The main quad is accomplished, so hopefully that goes well. You never know. I remember when they had Spirit and Opportunity, you know, they were so happy this thing landed, and the airbags had bounced half a dozen times, and the airbags unfurled, everything was good. Then they had trouble getting the rovers off the platform. So, you know, you never know until you go those extra couple of steps if everything's going to go okay. If your solar panels don't open, it'll be really mission over until the batteries quit. But the only other thing I had, of course, at the end of the month, which we're getting to, it'll be before the next net is Sunday. On the 31st, they are planning to launch Discovery up to the space station. They're going to bring the second component of the Japanese module Kaibo in the bay of the Discovery. So the seven astronauts will be arriving soon in Florida and getting ready to take that flight. So we'll be looking forward to that. We'll probably talk about it on next week's net.
providing it gets to them, you know, I think 50% of them go up on time, you know, usually weather-related problems or sometimes technical. We drop it. So, I don't have anything else further on Phoenix. I'll be looking forward to the science that it gets back. The engineering part is, of course, the real nail-biter. They can't do the science without the engineers getting this thing on board. And, I don't know, I heard years ago that engineers, their job is really not to make things strong, it's supposed to make things weak. I don't know how true that is, not being one, but I hope that wasn't the case with this. Seems like it isn't. They're able to get this thing from 10 months ago launching from Earth to the Mars atmosphere. You got to remember, this thing didn't go into orbit. You know, it's a direct shot. It's not like it's, you know, in orbit for a while and then they have time to work on things there. I mean, this thing arrived there and blasts right through the atmosphere. So everything has to go right, has to be timed right. One guy said there's a million different possibilities with things that could go wrong. And it was about 150 of them at the top of his list. But I would say out of 150, most of them have gone right up until this point. I don't know about the solar panels yet. They weren't having trouble with it. I just walked away from the TV to get on the net. But that was the next step. Maybe somebody has an update back to that. WSLA.
Yeah, this is a time when I'm very disappointed that my satellite system is not in operation. My 10-foot dish is up at the 60-foot level of one of my towers. It needs some repair. Ordinarily, I'd be watching NASA Select and seeing all of this live directly from Pasadena. When I say live, it's actually relayed through the TEDRA satellite back down to a site where it gets into another satellite that I watch. I can't even remember the name of the satellite right now. But that would be fun stuff to watch. If you're interested in space, it's real fun having a old-fashioned satellite receiving system, because the cable systems almost never carry NASA Select for any significant length of time. In places like Houston, Texas, they carry it on all the cable systems. But here in New York, they think that people are not interested in science. They think it's not a good paying client, so they keep finding excuses to drop it from the cable system. And so very few cable systems have it. I think with direct, if you've got the right service with DirecTV satellite reception, I think there is a NASA Select channel. Wonder if anyone within the sound of my voice is listening to that NASA Select at this time. If so, give us your call letter and name, K2RIW in the TechNet.
W2EWK. I have it now on my TV.
Okay, we heard Eugene, and Eugene doubled with somebody else. Who was the other person?
Sorry, Dick. DirecTV has NASA Select, by the way. I don't have it.
Okay, I think it's a premium service. You have to pay an extra fee for. Is that true, Paul?
Okay.
Negative, they have it. DirecTV, you get it automatic.
Yeah, I still think it's a premium service, though. Okay, Eugene, what are you seeing? What have they said so far, Eugene? Looks like you're the guy that's most up to date. W2EWK, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick, I was in my
garage
working this afternoon on my lawnmower and my generators and that stuff, and I said, oh, no. I looked at the rush. And I know the net was going on, so I had it on my TV, but I got the voice off, and I got the voice on my 2 meters right now talking to you. So right now, I'm just watching the picture only, and I don't pay no extra for the spaceship channel. I have free. It comes with my, I get... Let's see, I got the Animal Channel, I got CNN, and I got NASA, that's the three couple of channels which I want only, QSL.
Understand. Now, which service are you using, Eugene? Is it the 18-inch dish, DirecTV? Is it Verizon, Vios? Is it Cablevision, Amestor? Which one of the television services are you using that's giving you NASA Select? Back to you, Eugene.
Turn off the satellite, the 18-inch dish, the very small dish.
Okay, you're getting it by DirecTV, which I think is the service. It's called DirecTV. And did you buy some of the premium channels, or does the basic service give you that NASA Select? Go ahead.
They give it to me automatically with my package. How much does that sell? How much does the TV bill? Oh, it comes by $20. By $20. Only got a couple of channels only, and that's it.
Okay, sounds good. Sounds like the basic service then for DirecTV gives it to you. And that's rather attractive. So I guess, I don't know whether or not people with Verizon Vios service, the triple service, I wonder if they're getting NASA Select or you have to buy a premium package to get it. Does anybody know the answer to that? Give me your call letters right now.
Ryan says we pay $14 for those few channels that we got on the TV. It's only $14 per month only. Okay, Dick, right back to you, W2EWK.
Yeah, that's very tempting. I may have to reestablish that service, so either that or I got to fix my satellite system. I've got to catch up on some repairs. Alrighty. I think we've answered all the questions of all the people who signed in. I'm going to turn it over to Mel. He's going to open up his mailbag or tell us what's going on with the latest of the Kings County Radio Club. So we can open the mailbag a little earlier this time, Mel, if you so desire, and answer a few more of those questions. Drag your feet a little bit in case there's anyone else that wants to join us. K2KEY with a little bit of delay. K2RIW.
Dick, do you want me to pipe it to your home QCH by telephone? With a question mark?
I thank you for the offer, Eugene, but no. Please don't do that, but I thank you for the offer. I should have an incentive to fix my own system so that I can be watching it directly. Mel, you've got it.
Okay. Other comments? This is K2KEY. All right. Didn't get canceled earlier, so I didn't expect to. So let me see if I can grab a couple. Hold on a minute. Okay. So take this one off the top here. Let me see. Or I can put it out on the air. Question. Had an argument with a friend of mine, okay, about electric shock. Now, this is an unusual question. How much current does it have that would, how much current would flow through a human being to electrocute them? How many milliamps? I said milliamps. He said no, it has to be amperes. Am I right or is he right? Over.
Yeah, I was waiting for the beep, and maybe you're coming in by VOIP or whatever, because I didn't hear the beep on your signal. The rule that we used to memorize for the FCC exam way back in the 50s and 60s was 200 milliamps. 200 milliamps was considered lethal from hand to hand way back in the late 50s and early 60s. That number has gone up and down since then. That's hand to hand under worst case conditions, wet hands. if you put the current directly between the temples of a human being, I think a much smaller current can create detrimental effects, but nowhere near as high as an ampere. If you were electrocuting a man in the electric chair in a prison because the jury had decided that this is capital punishment and you want to do double damn sure, yes, you're going to use amperes. But if you're trying to protect yourself to make sure you're safe, I think you want to make sure that nothing even approaching 100 milliamps can flow through you. I believe the fault interrupters that you have, that you should be installing in bathrooms and other critical outlets on your house, ground fault interrupter, I think it trips at something like 20 or 50 milliamps just to be double darn sure. So it doesn't take very much current. If it was critically timed, it sets your heart into fibrillation. Your heart, if you ever see a electrocardiogram, is something called the RST wave, and there's a critical portion of that wave. If a pulse of current arrives at just the right time, it can send you into fibrillation. That's where the heart flutters very rapidly, but does very inefficient pumping, and it can make you unconscious and do even more damage than that if you're not defibrillated in some reasonable length of time. So, I would shoot for keeping it well under 50 milliamps to be on the safe side, in my opinion, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Now, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah. The rule of thumb was always, depending on a person's physical condition and a number of other factors, between 100 to 300 milliamps is electrocution. And actually, what it is, as far as what the doctors, and I remember reading what, you know, I've gotten interested, like you say, in fibrillation, how it works and all. It's actually what was called the area of the heart, was the right atrium of the heart, called the sinotrial node, I believe, something like that. I'm also not here ruining the word, but I believe it's thought sound. Do you know what I'm trying to get out, Dick? Over.
I'd recognize it if I heard it, but I can't tell you, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay, I'll spell it off the top of my head. S-I-N-O-A-T-R-I-A-L. Sinorial or trial. No, that's what they call the right atrium in the heart. And anything that induces a current flow through that part of the heart actually is called the fatal V-fifth. That's the way they described it. I mean, I just want to read what the doctors, you know, how they write it up. Now, is it true, just think about that, is it true that if you look at AC frequency of 50 cycles, do you think that the frequency going higher or lower would be less dangerous? In other words, does the frequency, how much effect do you think that has on your heart?
Sinoatrial or SA node.
Sinoatrial, SA node. A little bit noisy, but we heard that. If you're comparing the 60 hertz that we use in the United States versus the 50 hertz that's used in Europe, I think the difference in lethality is very small. A much bigger difference is that they tend to run 230 volts where we tend to run 110. And our normal outlets, and that can make a significant difference. The 230 that they run, some people think is potentially more lethal, and that may explain why most all of their outlets are protected. In other words, it's a three-pronged plug that you're putting into the wall, and the grounding plug has to be inserted first. It's the longer plug, and that's the one, when it's inserted into your socket, removes the protective plate that allows you to put the other two pins into the wall. So that stops a child that's crawling around the house with a bobby pin or a paper clip in his hand. It stops him from inserting it into the wall plug and giving himself an electrical shock. So the Europeans are much better on protecting their sockets than we are, because, and I think part of the reason is they run 230 volts at 50 hertz as opposed to our 115 or 120 at the 60 hertz. The majority of the world is on 50 hertz. There's only a small number of countries that are on 60 hertz. The majority of the world is on the metric system. Only a little bit of Japan and the United States and a couple of South American countries are on the non-metric system. So we're dragging our feet in some respects there, Mel. KQKEY, KQRIW.
Okay, yes, you brought up a good point that now the electrical code, I believe, called for that third pin, the grounding pin, so-called, to be on top so that if the plug is partially out of the wall, something falls across it, and it will not touch the two other pins first. So, all right, then the question is, oh boy, the part two, what is the, is low voltage safe? Because it doesn't cause electrical shock. Is there a danger in low, very low voltage, especially if the person is working on a low voltage circuit and he's very sweaty that day? Do you think there's any chance of injury? That's a good question also, Alvin.
Well, you will notice that your Cornell Dubilier rotator and other kinds of rotators, which have wiring that goes outside the house to the rotator that's up the tower or on the chimney, whatever, runs on something like 28 or 30 volts AC, not higher voltages. Unless the wiring is in a protected conduit, you cannot legally run more than something like 28 volts AC external to your house. Most of the time, if you come in contact with 28 volts, most of the time, it is not lethal. However, if I was one of those foolish people who every year in the past, a number of people in the United States die because they're standing in seawater with their rowboat upside down at a seashore with a metal-cased, old-fashioned drill motor in their hand, and they're sanding the bottom of their boat. You do something like that, and my goodness, are you close to death. If one little strand of wire inside of that drill motor touches the metal case while your feet are in seawater, it's game over. Even at 28 volts, if you stood in seawater and came in contact with 28 volts, I think there's a chance you're in trouble. But that's an extremely unusual contact situation. Most of the time, I believe 28 is safe. However, if I put two great big metal plates across your temples and apply 28 volts between them, I think there's a moderately good chance I could get you into a lot of trouble. I'd be doing the equivalent of electroshock therapy, and I may be doing an extreme amount of it, so to speak. So even 28 volts I would treat with respect, but the chances are probably 1/1000th as bad as they would be with 120 volts. 28 volts is that much safer most of the time, but still treat it with respect. If by some means you have extremely good sweaty hand contact with it, I think there's a slim chance you could get in trouble depending on the vulnerability of your particular SA node, of your particular coronary system. That's an opinion. KQKEY, KQRIW.
As far as low voltage goes, like battery, automobile battery, 12 volts. The only really risk that I have seen in the past, a friend of mine managed to get a ring, a gold ring wedding band, across the 12 volt battery in an automobile, which immediately turned to a red hot piece of metal and almost took his finger off. That's not an electrocution problem, but the same results, it can get just as badly hurt sometimes when dealing with low voltage and very high current. From no doubt that there is danger, from a tool getting across a high current supply, and the person holding it can, get some kind of serious burn. I would assume that, I think, the worst scenario, low voltage and high current, I would say, Dick, over.
WB2HWW, you want to comment?
How we recognize, get to you in a second. Before I'm allowed to work in the machine shop, and I do a lot of work in the machine shop because I'm always handcrafting crazy little antennas with exotic shapes that have to squeeze into tiny little corners of operating pieces of equipment. That's what I do as an occupation. I design antennas. So I'm in the machine shop. And before they would allow me in this large corporation into a machine shop, I had to take the safety course. And the safety course consists of watching about a one-hour movie that shows you about 50 different ways that you can break limbs and lose a lot of blood. In a machine shop, you have to make double darn sure you don't have long sleeves that can catch in the machinery. You don't have a tie that can catch in the machinery. You're going to be wearing safety glasses. You're going to keep your hands out of the way of the bandsaw, the circular saw, the lathe, the milling machine, the drill press. I mean, even a grinding wheel can get you into a lot of trouble. So you have to know some of the dangers ahead of time before you use a hand drill, a drill press, a bandsaw. All of these things can cut off fingers and do damage real fast. So when it comes to high current electrical equipment like you've got on an automobile, that automobile battery is capable of dishing out 300 or 400 amperes in a worst case scenario of a screwdriver or something that is equally conductive across the terminals. And the current and spark and heat that can create can do an awful lot of damage. So you have to have a healthy respect when you're working with these things. A smart person working on anything electrical of an automobile will disconnect the negative lead from the battery first. I've watched a guy replace the alternator in my automobile, and I kept telling him, you better disconnect the negative lead. He says, no, I'm going to save time. And every time he put his wrench in the wrong place, he was blowing the fuse, the fusible link, and before he finished replacing the alternator in my automobile car, he had to replace that fusible link twice. He wasted a lot of time because he refused to disconnect the negative lead from the battery before proceeding with the repair operation. Let's see what Howie's going to say about this. You got it, Howie. K2LAW in the TechNet.
Two things. Number one, it's not the amount of voltage or the current that you put across your body. It's the resistance of your body. You can have 12 volts. It's not how much current you can put out. It's how much current you're going to get. I think 100 milliamps is what's required. But second, yeah, in New York City, even 70-volt lines that they use for, you know, 70-volt constant transformers for your audio systems, where they use a 70-volt transformer output, where they use taps, that has to go into pipe. A lot of people, you know, just wire it up without it. They think it's audio, but that's the regulations. But it's the amount of current that that goes across your heart, and it's from, you know, across both hands. If you have a voltage across two things, you might not get killed, but I would have tried it. But you got to be careful you don't put a, you know, current through your body. Back to you, Dick.
Let me give you another crazy example. Thank you, Howie, for that information. A number of us have seen that old-fashioned movie where Doris Day is in her bathtub on the telephone talking to Cary Grant. Or talking to, was it Cary Grant? Or was it, not sure who he was now. Rock Hudson. I think she was talking to Rock Hudson. She's on the telephone while she's in this bubble bath in her tub. Very dangerous situation. Nobody's right mind would allow a telephone to be installed in a bathroom. The telephone itself runs on relatively low current, relatively low voltage, with the exception the ringing circuit runs at 90 volts. If you're in that bathtub with that telephone in your hand while somebody's ringing that telephone, that 90 volt ringing circuit I think could do you in. So be very careful with any electrical equipment that's mounted anywhere near the appliances in a bathtub, in a bathroom. There should be a ground fault interrupter on the connector, even for the connection that runs your electric shaver. Electric shavers and almost everything we use nowadays is double insulated. It's in a plastic box, so to speak, and you can't come in contact with anything metallic that's connected to anything electronic. But even to be double darn sure, you should have ground fault interrupters everywhere, because it's a couple of dollar items which can definitely save a life. very false economy not to have them installed. Even if you buy an older house that doesn't have them, you should have your favorite electrician add them to your house. K2KEY, K2RIW.
K2QIW.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay, did you copy me? Yeah, I just want to make a comment. This is 12WS Glenn.
We probably covered you up. Glenn, stand by for a minute. Paul, go ahead with your comment.
Okay, I wonder if you've heard this. In Europe, particularly in the Netherlands, I was working with one guy who was from that country, and he said that in the bathrooms they run one-to-one transformers in all the bathrooms throughout the Netherlands. This way you don't have any possibility of going to ground. So you touch one contact, if you touch a fourth, you won't be grounded. They have transformers everywhere. If you've heard that thing.
No, I haven't heard that. And I can see how it's going to give you a lot more protection, but it's not perfect. I can see a possibility, Paul, of a double error getting you in trouble. If two appliances simultaneously make contact to ground, one of them grounds the hot lead and one of them grounds the cold lead on the secondary winding of that isolation transformer you just described, you can still get electrocuted. So you're getting a lot more protection from that isolation transformer if it's in good working order and properly installed. And you can't just simply ground the cenotaph on the secondary winding of that transformer, because you're still going to have 65 volts each side of cenotaph, which is more than enough to get you in trouble in a bathroom. So I wouldn't trust that. I still want ground fault interrupters, and I'd like very few electrical appliances being capable of being run in my particular bathroom. If you really got to run an electrical appliance other than a hairdryer and an electric shaver, I think it should be run in some other room of the house. Back to you, Paul, for any further comments on that. WS2N, K2RIW.
WW, to comment on Europe.
K2IW, comment, mobile.
Yeah, all of those guys recognize Paul first. Go ahead, Paul.
You saw me, wow. Yeah, okay, understood that, Dick. Now, we're going back 15 years ago. I don't know what's changed. The GFIs were just coming out, becoming a big thing by that time. I'll let you pick up the other station, Dick.
Okay, Glenn next. KCQQIW, you got it, Glenn. KCQQIW, mobile, go ahead.
Yeah, hi. The name here is Joe. I'm in the mobile. I don't mean to cut anybody. I'll give you a quick one. KCQQIW. I ordered a DJ turntable called Techniques 1200. They sent me a European plug. And I looked in the back of the unit, and I believe it said it was different cycles. I don't remember either it was 50 or 60, but it didn't match up with the American. I forgot what's American. I think American 50 cycles. Well, make a long story short, I went to Radio Shack and I bought the adapter for it. I didn't trust it. Because the voltage is different, so I guess my question is, you think I should return it, send it back, and get the American plug back to the net, back to the dip?
Okay, Joe. I think you said turntable, and that is something that has to run at a very specific speed if it's running a record, for instance, if it's a record turntable, and most of Europe is on 50 hertz. All of the United States is on 60 hertz, and so when you run a 50 hertz designed piece of equipment that's supposed to turn at a very exact rate, that's what it is, turntable, disk drive or whatever, something that's supposed to turn at a very exact rate, and if you run it on 60 hertz American power, and it was designed for 50, I think you're going to be having problems. Even if you make the voltage right, Radio Shack can sell you a voltage converter that steps the voltage up or down and makes the voltage magnitude correct. But without spending a lot of money, I don't think Radio Shack is going to sell you a device that is a cyclo converter. I mean, there is a kind of machine that will take 60 hertz in and give you 50 hertz out, or vice versa. But they tend to be expensive. That's not a cheap Radio Shack product. So it sounds to me like this European product, if it must turn at a very exact speed, and if it's made for the European frequency, 50 hertz, I think the chances of you making it run correctly in the United States without a lot of rigmarole, I think it's very slim, and probably you should mail it back and say, hey, don't you guys realize I'm in the United States and you're sending me a European product? Very similar to what happens when quite often an American lady will go to Europe and plug in her hair dryer. Her hair dryer is made for 120 volts United States, and she plugs it into 230 volt European. And the hair dryer runs super fast for 5 seconds and then burns up in smoke. You can't do that. Back to you, Joe. KC2QIW. K2LIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick. Dick, I'm glad I asked the question. I'm driving, so it's kind of hard to remember. It was different. Either the 50 or the 60, but it didn't match up with American. I forgot now. America is 50, I believe, right? And yeah, it was different. So I did call up Program and State Lighting, and they did exchange it for me. Thank God. Even though it was past 30 days, I just didn't trust it. So I guess my question is, yeah, you answered my question. I guess I did the right thing. I did the right thing by exchanging it, and thank God they exchanged it for me and everything else. So everything's good now. Back to Dick.
WB2HWW.
How we recognize, yeah, they had to replace it from my point of view, even beyond the 30 days, Joe, because it was their error. They're shipping you an American, a European product to an American market, and they should realize the voltage and frequency differences. You called the object a turntable. Was it a record-turning turntable? Was it something that had to turn at an exact speed? Give me a break on that one, Joe. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's correct. I forgot to answer your question about that. Yeah, that's correct. It's a DC turntable. What happened was they only had like one in stock, so I couldn't compare it, you know. I sold my old ones on eBay. So what happened was they built me one, and they said when they get the rest in stock, they're going to mail me out the other one. So I just waited. I waited. And then finally, I got the second one. And the second one was American-made, and I compare with both, with the, you know, like I said, I read the back of it, it was different, so and that's when I did the exchange. But yes, it's a turntable with records.
Okay, you did the right thing. You would definitely be running at the wrong speed, and the music would sound pretty sour. Howie, you got it, K2LIW.
First thing is this, Dick. On the turntable, doesn't matter what frequency, the problem is it's a power supply. The turntable is going to be not be using 60 cycles to get the frequency. They probably use a phase lock loop, and they use, you know, they have an output device. They have a decoder or something that, like a tachometer or something that generates voltage and be able to generate the frequency. My original comment on Europe is that so the most European homes, and I lived in Europe for a while back in 94, is that the code would not allow you to have a switch, a light switch, inside the bathroom. The light switch was outside. It was so funny when I first went there. I went into the bathroom, and I was trying to put my, looking around for the light switch, looking for the light switch. The light switch is on the outside, you know, as you go into the door, as you walk into the bathroom, whatever, the switch would be, you know, on the wall outside. It was very interesting. You had to turn the light on outside the bathroom. And obviously they use 220 volts, and they use two prongs. They got these, it looks like two prongs. So most of your hair dryers today can run an either voltage. Second, when I was there, this lady friend I had, we had a turntable, we had a AM/FM CD player, and she got a voltage converter, and the thing had a hum. We had to change the filter cap, had to make the filter cap larger. So when you bring over stuff that's designed for 60 cycles, sometimes the filter supply isn't adequate enough to get rid of all the hum because it's designed for 60 cycles. As you go low in frequency, you need more capacitance. Back to you, Dick.
And you were able to describe, you were able to demonstrate your electrical engineering prowess because you were able to add the extra capacitor to get rid of the hum so that the 50 hertz power supply had enough energy storage to do the right voltage regulating. And I'm sure that was kind of fun. And I can see why they would put the switch outside the bathroom, just to make sure that you, with your wet feet standing on the floor after you get out of the shower, can't possibly touch a live switch when you operate the light switch. And that's on the super safe side. We've got ways of insulating the switch itself to make it safer. I think nowadays the switch in the bathroom has got to have no metallic plate to it. I think everything you come in contact with is only plastic. And it's got ground fault interrupters, whatever. But the number of electrical appliances you should operate in a bathroom or near the sink in the kitchen, the number of electrical appliances should be very, very few. Properly grounded, I think a microwave oven is okay, a toaster is okay, properly grounded. I think some of the older toasters only had a 2-pound plug, which may not be very safe. On top of that, there are people who get something stuck inside the toaster and leave it plugged into the wall. Even with the toaster not running, they'll reach in there with a metallic object, a knife or a fork or whatever, trying to retrieve the object from a toaster. Very dangerous operation. Nobody should do that. Unplug the toaster before you try to remove anything that's inside of it. Lots of people get in trouble doing those kind of things. Okay, I think it's time to go on to the next thing in your mailbag mail. K2KEY. K2RIW.
Before you go on, can I ask a question on this week, on this subject?
Hey, go ahead, Howie.
Two things. One, I know why in Europe they have 220 volts, because the higher the voltage, the less copper for the same current. Do you know, or anyone here can answer, why Europe choose 50 cycles and why Europe choose 60? And also, when you're in Europe, all the AM broadcast stations are 9 KC steps. When you get into a car in Europe, it's, you know, like 88, it's 880, 889, 998, so on. Two reasons. Maybe you don't know the answer for, maybe you know the answer why in Europe they chose 9 kilohertz steps for the AM broadcast and why they choose 50. Was it just politics?
Don, good question, and I don't know. Very similar to the fact that color television, the old-fashioned analog color television, there are 14 separate standards in the world for color television. And there are countries in Africa where two countries side by side intentionally chose an opposite standard for color television, supposedly so that the people from one country are unable to watch color television from the adjacent country. So in a lot of cases it's political. But 50 versus 60, I wonder if anyone knows the reason for that one. Why was 50 chosen for essentially all of Europe? And why has the northern hemisphere of the United States chosen 60 hertz? I can see in the case of the power station, less iron is used for your rotary machinery and your transformers when you run at 60 versus 50. So they're spending more money on the iron, but because their voltage is higher, they're spending less voltage, less money on the copper. Six of one, half a dozen the other. Anyone got any explanation for why one standard over the other was chosen? Give me your call letters right now. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2KEY.
Go ahead, Mel. And where did the information come from? How did you find it out?
Okay, well, let me put it this way. I read some quick little pieces of this. At the time, early times when they first were, of course, the big battle was originally when Edison, you know, was in love with DC, and he refused to change over. Of course, you heard that story, how the crazy things that they did in electrocuting animals and all using AC and DC. That began the controversy. However, with the situation was that they were trying not to encourage the import of American-made products such as generators and things like that by showing that they are not going to be compatible with what they came up with, that we were on 60 cycles and a company like Westinghouse, General Electric, did not see at that time a big enough market to compete in. So that this was a discouragement because of that. And then there was patents. Oh boy, the day goes through with the patents. I don't even begin to tell you about patents. You know, there were certain patents even on, remember, on the early vacuum tubes and all, that they said even hams, if you went and had to use a certain vacuum tube, you were violating patent regulations. So there was a lot of bouncing back and forth with that. There was also a lot of controversy that had really stemmed from the beginning with Bell, believe it or not, the Bell telephone system, and his ongoing problems with patents, whether or not because the Europeans didn't want to recognize. In other words, they wanted to just manufacture the product similar to what the Japanese did and all, or the Chinese do, and say, the heck with your patent involvement, Dick Over.
Interesting. Now, without a doubt, in the early days, Edison was strongly in favor of DC and didn't like AC. However, Edison wasn't a complete fool. He did see the merits of the Westinghouse and Tesla system of three-phase AC. One of the things that when you dig deep enough into the history, you'll find out that Edison accepted a contract to wire the whole town in Massachusetts that contained a shoe factory. I can't think of the name of the town right now. But he wired the whole town, including the shoe factory, with three-phase, 60-cycle AC. And it was an extremely successful project done by Edison. He did it slightly after the time he was wiring a couple of city streets in New York City, Manhattan, with DC. I think he followed through on the DC system for political reasons or because he had already ordered the equipment and didn't want to make a change. I think by the time he was doing the installation in New York City, he knew of some of the problems that DC was going to give him. But he did install three-phase, 60-cycle AC power in a town in Massachusetts that contained a shoe factory. He first wired up the shoe factory very successfully, then he wired up the whole rest of the town. Back to you, Mel, K2RIW.
Roger, I think it was a place called, if I'm not mistaken, jumped into my mind, a place called Stoneham, Mass. And, yeah, it was a very successful system that he did put in. And, of course, like you say, the original was the wiring of New York City, original demonstration of lighting up the city block in New York City was with DC. Now, the problem, of course, was the, I guess, basically, there was, you know, a number of squabbles that were going on. I'll put the word squabbles about, you know, patents you know, who had the rights to this and that. So they said, oh, the heck with you. The heck with you. So we went on to the 60-cycle system. They went on to the 50. Said, listen, you can't sell your product here in Europe. Europeans can't sell their product here in the United States. As far as the turntables, well, now you go back to my days of turntables, like ones like Garage, Record Cut, and all those were the popular turntables, 60-cycle modem. But what they did for export and importing them, like telephone, and made record players. I worked back for them one time in the United States division of the Telephone Corporation. And we used to, for American use, we used to change the high plug, on the motor, the step pulley, to make it, you know, compatible for use with 60 cycle sticks. The motor ran perfect on either 50 or 60 cycles over.
So by changing the size or diameter of the capstan, you've got everything to run at the right speed. Very crafty. Europe has got a number of standards that are different than us. 230 volts instead of our 120, 50 hertz instead of our 60, and most of their radio and wireless cabling is done with 70 hertz Z0 cables compared to our 50, that's a 70 ohm compared to our 50 ohm. And their motivation for using 70 ohms is that it's got a lower insertion load compared to 50. 50 can tolerate higher power, 70 has less insertion loss. So most of their, much of their instrumentation is 70 ohms. I'm trying to think of some of the other differences. We use the exact same definition for antenna gain, isotropic, so we have no difference there. 1 volt in Europe and 1 volt in the United States is essentially the same. 1 meter in Europe and 1 meter in the United States is the same. The word ton, the British ton versus the American ton, they differ. The British mile and the American mile differ a little bit. I'm trying to think of some of the other things that differ. But what was that again, Bill?
TV channel spacing, AM channel spacing is different. Here is 10 kc, there is 9 kilohertz.
Yeah, on top of that, we've got 6 megacycle separation on our television channels, and I think they have 8. They transmit the 625 lines, we transmit 525 lines, they use the PAL system, phase alternate line system, and their television channels are separated by 8 megacycles, ours are separated by 6 megacycles. Mel, I think you had another comment you were going to make?
The BTU system, I think, is universal. That British thermal unit, I think, is the same, based on the same council.
Yeah. The word calorie and BTU and the word watt and ampere and volt, those are all the same. Their word billion is very different than our word billion. Our system is based on exponents of changing of 3. When you go from 1 hertz to a kilohertz, you're changing by 10 to the 3. Kilohertz to megahertz, you're changing by 3. Megahertz to gigahertz, you're changing by 3. Well, when it comes to their money, $1,000, we know what that is. $1 million, we know what that is. But $1 billion to them is 10 to the 12 dollars. To us, it's 10 to the 9 dollars. To them, $1 billion is $1 million million. So when they want to say what we call a billion, they call it 1,000 million. So they've got a crazy difference on that one. Their billion is not the same as our billion. And I haven't checked, but if they have the word trillion, it must be something really weird by our standards. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Sounds very interesting.
All right.
Anybody want to make any comments about any of this or above before we go on?
WS2N.
Telephones ring over there at different air. They have different frequencies for dial tone and busy and the ring. The ring frequencies are totally different over there.
Makes sense. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, yeah, you were talking about the BTUs. You look at the boiler, and then you get into pressures, and they deal with kilopascals, but we're dealing with pounds per square inch. So that's always a problem. If you look at your gauge on your boiler, your KPA, there'll be two sets of numbers, and then you'll see your PSI. So that's a little crazy there too, Dick. And Mel, Georgia, the comment to Mel, Georgia from Pennsylvania sent out those emails to everybody on a billion, talking about a billion, what a billion seconds ago was. Turns out 1959 and all. I don't know if you got that, Mel, but he went on and on about the billion. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
Yeah, when it comes to the metric units, there's a significant difference whether or not you're metric or non-metric. We measure pressure in pounds per square inch. Well, the inch is not very respected. The foot is not very respected. To people who are on the metric system, which is 98% of planet Earth, most of the countries in the world are metric. They measure things in meters and centimeters and millimeters and kilometers. Everything metric. And so therefore, and they also measure force in newtons, not in pounds. And a newton, I think, is 1 meter per second of acceleration. of a 1 kilogram mass. That's the force of 1 newton, which is very different than our definition of a pound.